This morning's sermon is number 5 in a series on what it means to love other people in the sense of the New Testament word agape, a very special word in the vocabulary of the Apostle Paul. When he writes to the church in Thessalonica and pleads with them to enlarge the circle of their caring, this is how it comes out. May the Lord cause you to increase your love to one another and to everybody. Now, we can hear that passively, the way Scripture is typically heard in churches, or we can really think about it and challenge it, which is how we ought to hear it. And if we do that and we're honest, we may very well say, come on now, Paul, quit kidding. Because in the usual sense of our English word, we simply do not love everybody. Love in our language is all tied up with feelings, with emotions, and telling us to feel a certain way simply does not work. It isn't common, but sometimes, in a good mood, we may manage a sudden flash of warmth toward a stranger. We see an old man limping courageously down a marina boardwalk with a jaunty Greek fisherman's cap on his head, and we like that pizzazz. We have a very good idea what putting up that front costs him, and so affectionately we wish him well. I sat in the main library at the University of Oklahoma a while back, reading some things while waiting for my son to finish teaching classes in the very same building I had occupied before he was born. I had forgotten that this huge high-ceilinged reading room, hushed like a cathedral, is one of the most beautiful rooms I have ever seen. I sat at a table in a great chair of leather and oak and looked around at the young men and women bent over books, lost in their work, intense in their pursuit of knowledge, shut away for a blessed while from their cars and their easy laughter, from football games and casual courtships. And I felt a sudden affection for them, strangers though they were. I love all of you, I thought, knowing very well what the cost of years to come would be for each one of them. Only yesterday I was where you are now, as full of hope and as incapable as you are of imagining all the twists and turns of a lifetime. May the world be as kind to you as it has been to me. But this tender feeling about a stranger is not the norm for me or anyone else. It only happens occasionally. Most of the time, we have no special feelings for people we don't know. We stand in an elevator with strangers, pass them on the street, ride with them on a plane or a bus, and we're not likely to be swept by sudden affection, by indifference, mostly, sometimes by annoyance, but hardly by anything we would call love. And yet, to people like us who claim to honor Christ, Paul said, make the circle larger. Increase your love to all people. But how is that possible? I mean, after all, isn't this hot-headed Paul talking who on more than one occasion absolutely blistered some people he didn't like, whose temper could go off at times like a bomb? How well does he do loving everybody? Well, we have learned already in this series that the word Paul uses is agape, which is not the usual word for love in the vocabulary of his time. The usual word was eros, a word that describes affection for what is attractive. One felt eros for another person because she liked the way that person looked or acted. But agape is a different word altogether, which commands a certain kind of response to other people, no matter how they look or act. I'm formal for just a moment now, but listen carefully, please. Agape love is not aroused by something good or attractive in its object. It doesn't come into existence because somebody else is lovable. It has nothing to do with liking. It has everything to do with conduct, with how we treat people. And that brings us back to Paul's wanting us to love everybody. We know perfectly well we can't like everybody, but we also know that it's possible to treat people right, love them in Paul's sense, even when we don't like them. Let me give you an example of how that may work. Let's suppose, and it is a hypothetical case, but let's suppose that I take my car to a mechanic who has met me once or twice and has decided he doesn't like me. It happens. All too often, probably. I leave my car, and while I'm away, he runs into a problem he hadn't expected. Now, he can do a quick fix, save time, and count on the high probability that I will never know and it will never make any difference. Or he can refuse to take that shortcut because I'm a fellow human being and he believes in doing the right thing. He may say to himself silently, if this were my car, I'd want it fixed right, so I'll fix it that way. What I'm trying to say to you over and over, because it is so important, is that in the New Testament sense, this man has shown agape love. He has cared about me without regard to his personal emotions. The first sermon in this series made the point that this is the only kind of love that can be commanded. Feelings cannot be commanded. Conduct can. I can love a person I do not like simply by treating that person as I would wish to be treated. And that is, we suddenly realize, the golden rule. What you would want in the way of treatment from others, do the same for them. And the interesting thing is, although no one ever says it in the Bible, that if you treat people well whom you dislike, after a while there is a high probability that you will both begin to find each other much more likable. But whether you ever do or not is beside the point. You are to demonstrate caring and concern and fairness regardless of how you feel. This is what agape love means. And using that word, Paul wrote to the Roman church, love does no wrong to a neighbor. Therefore, love is actually the fulfilling of the law. Neighbor has nothing to do with who lives next door. My neighbor, in the biblical sense, is anyone I meet, anywhere, who may at a given moment have a claim upon my compassion or kindness. And love fulfills the law because the law makes minimal demands and love goes beyond it. The law says I must not harm my neighbor. It does not say I have to help him. But someone else does. I have given you a new commandment that you love one another. Now let's come back to the opening words of that famous section we are examining, the 13th chapter of 1 Corinthians. I may be able, Paul says, to speak the language of men and even of angels, but if I have no love, my speech is no more than a noisy gong or a clanging bell. We've spent two of our Sundays talking about that single verse. Now we move on with Paul as he names in quick sequence the greatest gifts he can imagine and says that they too are worthless unless love controls the use of them. Listen to these astonishing words. I may have the gift of inspired preaching. I may have all knowledge and understand all secrets. I may have all the faith needed to move mountains, but if I have no love, I am nothing. I may give away everything I have and even give my body to be burned, but if I have no love, this does me no good. In a lifetime of reading, I can't recall ever having found in any literature in the world, an author who praises and elevates love the way Paul does in this paragraph. So let's take a closer look for just a minute at each amazing remark, keeping in mind that this is not romantic love or family affection or friendship, but agape love. If I had all knowledge, Paul says, if I knew everything about everything, but lacked this thing called love, what good would it do me? Now, I suppose we could respond, well, if we knew everything, we could write books and make money. We could do research and become famous, except that about that time, Paul would be looking at us with such utter disbelief that we would probably just stop. And if we stopped for a moment, we would realize that Paul had a context for what he said. He wasn't simply shooting off Roman candles of rhetoric. And here was the context. There were some people in his new little church who thought they were much smarter than all the rest. Paul seems to agree that, yes, they probably are. But he qualifies the compliment by saying that there is a better gift than their brilliance. And here is what he had in mind. Some of the church members in Corinth simply didn't know whether it was all right to eat meat that had been sacrificed to an idol and then offered for sale in a butcher shop. Others had decided that this was silly. That since idols had no real existence anyway, it didn't matter whether one ate that meat. And from Paul's own point of view, they, that last group, are right. But while he shared their more sophisticated knowledge, he did not share the spirit with which they held it. They were forgetting to love the ones who were not as smart as they were. Paul was an exceptionally brilliant man himself, trained under the most famous teacher of the time, and he dearly loved learning. Never would he put that down. When he wrote to Timothy, he said, "Bring my books when you come, especially the parchments." And he suggested in his Roman letter that when God gave us brains, he meant for us to use them. But he had discovered that knowledge without agape love, without genuine caring, may only puff up, in contrast to love which builds up. So he won't allow his emancipated friends to indulge their superior wisdom and strength of conscience at the expense of those who were still weak and worried and wondering. As Paul put it earlier in this same letter to Corinth, while brilliance may make a person look big, it is only love that can make one truly grown up. That is not the wisdom of the world, but it is the wisdom of New Testament Christianity. And Paul pushes that argument to the outer limits of credibility. Even if you have so much faith that you can do what seems to be impossible, and you are not controlled and motivated by love, your life falls short of what it is meant to be. Even if you give generously to the poor, even if you go so far in giving that you finally give your own body to be burned as a martyr, and there is no love behind all that giving, it profits you nothing. Now, when I see someone giving generously, I simply assume that love has prompted the giving. But Paul seems to think it's possible to have other motives. And if we think about it for a while, some of them come to mind. We may give out of fear, out of hope of having a reward, even to win relief from a guilty conscience. I know in my heart I got this money in selfish and brutal ways. Maybe if I give some of it away, I can feel better about myself. The gift may still be helpful to those who get it. Paul only argues that without love, it does us no good who give it. It's hard to imagine that a person could go so far as to give her own life and make even that ultimate sacrifice without love for the wrong reasons. But perhaps Paul had actually seen people court martyrdom out of bravado, out of calculation of one's place in history or in heaven. That one is hard for me to think, that even the ultimate sacrifice might be selfish. But Paul leaves that possibility open. And I cannot emphasize enough the startling nature of what he says, that it is love. I mean concern, genuine caring, that gives value to every single talent. Agape love is the ultimate secret. And so next week, we will begin to watch Paul as he holds up this special kind of love and lets the blazing light of his mind play over it like sunlight over a prism, so that every element can be isolated and looked at carefully. Please come back and watch the demonstration.